I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW on its 47th birthday. It is such an exciting day. We ask you to go to the phone as WPFW celebrates SNCC and Dore Ladner and so much more. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or a daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. Yeah! For at least the next 6 weeks, which is what is currently on the table.
As the official death toll in Gaza tops 30,500, and Israeli forces continue their deadly attacks, Vice President Kamala Harris calls for a ceasefire. The move comes after Israeli soldiers open fire on Palestinians desperately seeking food aid in Gaza City. We'll go to Rafah to speak with journalist Akram Al-Sattari, whose brother was at the aid convoy when Israeli soldiers opened fire. Then to Russia for an update after thousands gathered Friday in Moscow for the funeral of opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who suddenly died in an Arctic prison last month.
I came to remember a good man who was deprived of his life. His family was deprived of love, of everything. We had hopes for him. It's very unfortunate. We are very worried.
And to Alabama, where reproductive health and medical groups have requested the Alabama Supreme Court revisit its February ruling that frozen embryos should be considered children. Alabama Republicans blocked a bill that would create federal protections for in vitro fertilization, introduced by Senator Tammy Duckworth, who had both her daughters using in vitro fertilization.
Women willing to go through expensive, painful medical treatments just for a chance to experience the smallest, most banal moments of parenthood. Just to have a newborn to swaddle, a baby whose diaper needs to be changed, a toddler who needs their shoes to be tied. And if you believe that they have the right to be called mom without also being called a criminal, then all you have to do to prove it is to let us pass this should be obvious legislation.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Health officials in Gaza say at least 16 children have died in recent days from starvation and dehydration as Israel's assault on Gaza continues. UNICEF is warning the number of child deaths will likely, quote, rapidly increase unless the war ends. Pediatricians in Gaza say they have nothing to give malnourished children.
Yes, malnutrition plays a major role in the number of children that come to us, and thus in the number of deaths there are. When a child is supposed to eat three meals a day and ends up eating one meal, that's not enough for him. Your body becomes deficient in carbohydrates, vitamins, proteins, and deficient in fats that are necessary for the body. Then the body goes into a severe dehydration state. I can honestly say that we can't even deal properly with 50, 60% of the cases we receive, because we have nothing to give them. The most we can do for them is either give them saline solution or sugar solution.
On Sunday, Vice President Kamala Harris called for a ceasefire in Gaza. She made the comments in a speech in Selma, Alabama, marking the 59th anniversary of Bloody Sunday.
And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. Yeah! For at least the next 6 weeks, which is what is currently on the table.
The U.S. Vice President's remarks came 3 days after the United States blocked a U.N. Security Council statement condemning Israel after Israeli soldiers opened fire on Palestinians seeking aid in Gaza City in a massacre that left 112 people dead and over 700 injured. On Sunday, officials in Gaza accused Israeli forces of killing and wounding dozens more aid seekers who gathered at the Kuwaiti roundabout in Gaza City. Facing growing international criticism, President Biden on Friday announced the U.S. would begin airdropping food into Gaza. While reading from an index card, Biden twice mistakenly referred to Ukraine instead of Gaza.
In the coming days, we're going to join with our friends in Jordan and others in Friday airdrops of additional food and supplies into Ukraine and seek to continue to open up other avenues into Ukraine, including the possibility of a Marine corridor to deliver large amounts of humanitarian assistance.
On Saturday, the U.S. Air Force and Royal Jordanian Air Force dropped 38,000 ready-to-eat meals into Gaza, enough for one meal for about 1.6% of Gaza's population. Humanitarian groups say far more aid is needed in Gaza, where a quarter of the population is on the verge of famine. Major protests against Israel's assault on Gaza were held Saturday in a worldwide day of action. In San Francisco, police fired pepper spray and hit protesters with batons as a march passed the Israeli consulate. Thousands also marched in New York, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Albuquerque, Charlotte, and other cities. Protesters in Washington, D.C. included the longtime peace activist Kathy Boylan with the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker. She called on Biden to stop arming Israel.
We're dropping some food and we're dropping the bombs and the tanks and the bullets and everything else at the same time. That's what he's got to do. Stop sending the money and the weapons.
Negotiations for a temporary ceasefire faced another setback Sunday when Israel boycotted talks in Cairo after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Hamas of not agreeing to provide a list of all living Israeli hostages. On Saturday, thousands of Israelis marched in Tel Aviv against Netanyahu.
Israel is being controlled by a coalition of semi-dictatorial fascist people who don't have the good of the people in their hearts. We're being misled and led into this endless war that doesn't have an end in sight. Our government doesn't care about the more than 100 hostages that are held in Gaza right now. Our government doesn't care about the people of Israel. They only care about their own interests. They're all criminals. They're crooks. They need to go out.
On Sunday, Israeli War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz arrived in the United States in what's being described as an unauthorized trip. Gantz, who is seen as a rival to Netanyahu, is scheduled to hold talks with Vice President Kamala Harris and other top officials. Netanyahu has reportedly lashed out at Gantz for making the trip without his approval. The Israeli embassy in Washington has been instructed not to facilitate Gantz's trip. In more news from the region, Israel repeatedly attacked southern Lebanon Saturday, killing at least 7 members of Hezbollah. There are reports the dead included a grandson of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. Meanwhile, in the Red Sea, a UK-owned cargo ship, the Ruby Mar, sank on Saturday, days after it was attacked by Houthi forces from Yemen. Greenpeace has warned the sinking could result in a major environmental crisis since the ship was carrying 21,000 metric tons of fertilizer and a large amount of fuel. The Ruby Mar is the first ship to sink in the Red Sea since the Houthis began attacking ships to protest Israel's assault on Gaza. Nikki Haley beat Donald Trump in the Republican primary in Washington, D.C. Sunday. Haley won about 63% of the vote, making her the first woman ever to win a Republican primary. But her victory came just a day after Trump easily won Republican caucuses in Michigan, Missouri, and Idaho, giving him a commanding lead in the race ahead of Super Tuesday tomorrow. 15 states will hold primaries and caucuses. In Ukraine, at least 12 people have died after a Russian drone struck a nine-story apartment building in the city of Odessa Saturday. The dead reportedly included at least five children, the youngest being 4 months old. Other news on Ukraine, the German military has launched an internal probe after a Russian news outlet obtained tape of a private meeting where German officials discussed providing Ukraine with long-range missiles that could be used to destroy the Kerch Bridge, which links Russia to occupied Crimea. During the leaked call, one German general is heard saying, quote, "There is no real reason to say we can't do this. It only depends on the political red lines," he said. In Russia, crowds are continuing to lay flowers at the grave of opposition leader Alexei Navalny, buried Friday after thousands attended his funeral in Moscow. Navalny died 2 weeks ago at an Arctic prison. According to one count, 45 people were arrested across Russia for publicly paying respects to Navalny. We'll have more on Russia later in the program. The United Nations Human Rights Chief has called on the warring sides in Sudan to give safe access to humanitarian agencies as the crisis worsens. Volker Türk spoke in Germany Friday.
Sudan has become a living nightmare. Almost half of the population, 25 million people, are in urgent need of food and medical aid. Some 80% of hospitals have been put out of service. The apparently deliberate denial of safe and unimpeded access for humanitarian agencies within Sudan itself constitutes a serious violation of international law and may amount to war crime.
Volker Türk speaking in Geneva on Friday. Lawmakers in Pakistan have elected Shehbaz Sharif to serve as Pakistan's new prime minister for a second time, despite protests by supporters of Imran Khan, the imprisoned former leader of Pakistan ousted in 2022. Allies of Khan won the most seats in February's election, but fell short of a majority, allowing Sharif to form a coalition government. Khan supporters say the election in February was rigged to prevent them from winning more seats. This is Artaj Gul, who served in Khan's government.
Shehbaz Sharif cannot deliver to this country because he is not elected by the people of Pakistan. He has stolen the credit of the people of PTI people, and he has stolen the vote of Pakistani people. He cannot deliver. He's been imposed on the public of Pakistan.
Haiti has declared a 72-hour state of emergency after armed groups stormed two of the country's largest prisons, freeing as many as 4,000 prisoners. The jailbreak came as Haiti's unelected and deeply unpopular prime minister, Ariel Henry, was visiting Kenya to sign an agreement that would allow the deployment of 1,000 Kenyan police officers to Haiti as part of a U.S.-backed security plan. One of the most powerful gang leaders in Haiti, Jimmy Charizier, who is known as Barbecue, has openly threatened to topple Henry, who's ruled Haiti with the backing of the U.S. since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in July 2021. Charizier spoke on Friday.
We ask the Haitian National Police and the military to take responsibility and arrest Ariel Henry. Once again, the population is not our enemy. The armed groups are not your enemy. You arrest Ariel Henry for the country's liberation. These weapons that we have are not here to hurt our brothers who come from the same milieu as us. The poor take the streets and they trust us. These weapons are our symbol of freedom. With these weapons, we will liberate the country, and these weapons will change the country.
The largest wildfire in Texas history continues to grow and has spread into Oklahoma. As of Sunday, the Smokehouse Creek fire was only 15% contained and had burned a size of land larger than the state of Rhode Island. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said on Sunday the blaze, which occurred amidst record heat, is a sign that the nation must be better prepared for extreme weather caused by climate change. in health news. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has dropped its guidance that individuals who test positive for COVID-19 should isolate for 5 days. Under the new guidelines, the CDC urges people to stay home until symptoms improve and they have been fever-free for 24 hours. The new guidelines are similar to CDC recommendations for flu and other respiratory viruses. Federal authorities are investigating the death of Nex Benedict, a 16-year-old non-binary high school sophomore who died in February, a day after they were assaulted by three girls in a high school bathroom. The U.S. Education Department said Friday it's opened a probe into whether the Owosso Public Schools District, quote, failed to appropriately respond to alleged harassment, unquote, faced by Nex. Family members said Nex faced bullying since last year. Their cause of death has yet to be determined. And a judge in Colorado has sentenced a paramedic to 5 years in prison for his role in the 2019 death of Elijah McClain, the 23-year-old black young man who was walking home from the store when he was tackled by police, placed in a carotid hold, and later injected with ketamine, a powerful sedative. The sentencing of Peter Sichuniak comes after he and another paramedic were found guilty in December of criminally negligent homicide for McClain's death. During the trial, an expert witness testified there was no reason for the paramedics to give McClain ketamine. They were also found to have failed to provide medical care to McClain after they drugged him and he lay handcuffed and unconscious on the ground. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza, where Palestinian health officials say at least 16 children have died in recent days from starvation and dehydration as Israel's assault continues. UNICEF warns the number of child deaths will likely rapidly increase unless the war ends. Palestinians in Rafah searched Sunday under the rubble of a family home hit by an Israeli airstrike the night before that killed as many as 14 people, including a father and twin babies born in the last few months.
We want the United States to get away from us. We don't want anything from them. We don't want anything from the United States. They are lying and conspiring against us. God is my suffice and the best deputy.
Here in the United States, Vice President Kamala Harris Sunday called for a ceasefire in Gaza. She made the comments in a speech in Selma, Alabama, marking the 59th anniversary of Bloody Sunday.
And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. Yeah! For at least the next 6 weeks, which is what is currently on the table. This will get the hostages out and get a significant amount of aid in. This would allow us to build something more enduring, to ensure Israel is secure, and to respect the right of the Palestinian people to dignity, freedom, and self-determination. Hamas claims it wants a ceasefire. Well, there is a deal on the table. And as we have said, Hamas needs to agree to that deal. Let's get a ceasefire. Let's reunite the hostages with their families. And let's provide immediate relief to the people of Gaza.
Vice President Harris spoke 3 days after the United States blocked a UN Security Council statement condemning Israel after Israeli soldiers opened fire on Palestinians seeking aid in Gaza City in a massacre that left at least 118 people dead. On Sunday, officials in Gaza accused Israeli forces of killing and wounding dozens more aid seekers who'd gathered at the Kuwaiti roundabout in Gaza City. Facing growing international criticism, President Biden Friday announced the United States would begin airdropping food aid into Gaza. Negotiations for a temporary ceasefire faced another setback Sunday when Israel boycotted talks in Cairo after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Hamas of failing to provide a list of all living Israeli hostages. Meanwhile, Israeli War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz is in the U.S. for what's being described as an unauthorized trip to hold talks with Vice President Harris, Tony Blinken, and other top officials. Gantz is seen as a rival to Netanyahu, who reportedly lashed out at Gantz for making the trip without his approval. All of this comes as the official death toll in Gaza has topped 30,500. For more, we go to Rafah for an update from Akram al-Sattari, the Gaza-based journalist. Akram, your brother was at the aid convoy when Israeli soldiers opened fire. What did he explain to you happened, what's being now called the flour massacre, for the flour that people were coming to get to make bread?
Good morning, Amy. Yes, indeed, my brother was one of the people who were targeted by the Israeli tanks and artillery fire in that area of Al-Rashid Street, particularly Al-Nablusi roundabout, when they were trying to seek food for their children. To start with, it is the very personal story of my brother and mine, who was in direct contact with me, seeking to secure any help whatsoever for his children. He was taking that unsafe trip towards Al-Nablusi roundabout. He was waiting there. He was waiting from 3 in the afternoon. He was hoping that he would get at least some wheat flour for his children, because they have not eaten bread for around 25 days or even more than 25 days. He saw many people there coming from the Gaza north as well, in the hope that they can secure some food for their children. All of a sudden, the bombardment started. Not the bombardment, rather the tanks, gunfire started. And of course, the tanks are using 1.5 millimeter caliber guns, and those guns are very lethal. They can split a person into two halves. The fire started. The tanks never stopped shooting at them. And the observation that was made by the people who were there, including my brother, that the number of the tanks that were present in that particular time was in the sense that in the last few days, those tanks were like there, but not in the large number that was in that particular day. The fire started. The fire never stopped. People were shot. People were falling on the ground. People were running. And some of the wounded people were grabbing the legs of the other people, asking them to save and help them. The ones even whose legs were pulled were shot as well and were killed. So people were crawling. My brother told me that he was crawling for around 1.5 kilometers from this Al-Nablusi roundabout up to Al-Shalihat roundabout, which is an area that is around 1 kilometer or 1.2 kilometer far away from the area that they were in. The firing never stopped, and to him, it looked like that was pre-planned, and that the massacre that was planned, according to the description of my brother and any other people, was intentional, and the firing never stopped till that very large number of people were killed. And a very large number of people also was injured. Some of them are dying every day. And this specific incident was replicated the day after this massacre took place, and the day 3 days or even 4 days after that. So it looks like this is a policy that is followed by the Israeli occupation army, and it looks like the objective is to continue the starvation of the people of Gaza and to kill them when they dare to think that they can secure something to feed their children. So they were killed when they're trying to get the wheat flour. They were killed while they were seeking life.
So the Israeli military says it started a preliminary review and that Israeli forces did not attack the convoy, but that most of the fatalities were caused by a stampede. At the same time, the director of Al-Auda Hospital told the United Nations some 80% of the wounded brought into the hospital had been shot. If you could respond further, Akram.
Well, according to the preliminary diagnosis of the hospital and of the people who were there, most of the people who were there were suffering from upper body parts injuries, which is indicative of the gun that was used, of the fire that was used against them. Some of them were hit also by shrapnel because of the artillery fire that was hit at them. Of course, if I were Israel, if I were the occupation, I would tell the world that I have already started a preliminary investigation, and they might also... came from Mars and shot the Palestinians who were not using any arms and who were seeking to feed their children. That's typical. That's normal. This is the Israeli habit. They will say, because they targeted the Baptist hospital, and they also said that was not them. That was an Islamic Jihad rocket, a missile that hit the people and killed around 600 people. That's normal. But the issue now, if the international community is failing to compel Israel to conduct a scrutiny into the things that happened, I think the international community failed before and is still failing to stop the ongoing atrocities, and is helping somehow when they are condoning the ongoing bombardment. They are failing to do justice for the people of Palestine, and they are failing to observe the international humanitarian law coordinates, international humanitarian law dictates that allow, that asks the government to take whatever precautions are needed to protect the civilian population that is living in Gaza, extremely difficult conditions. Food. They are not living in a fire exchange. They are seeking food for their families and for their children and for themselves, and they ended up being killed. So Israel will deny, and I wouldn't be surprised to also if Israel said that they were killed by other Palestinians. That is a scenario I think that is extremely acceptable for Israel, and Israel allies would buy anything from Israel. So no need. The ones who were killed are just Palestinians. Palestinians who were treated as second grade humans, who are still besieged, who are still starving, who are still killed, who are still displaced for around six or seven or eight times, and who are expecting more of the misery and the death and displacement. So the international community is failing, and I don't think the Palestinians trust any statements made by the Israeli army about any preliminary investigation, because there were many preliminary investigations to be done, but they were never done. And there was many justice that is expected to be done for the Palestinians, but was not done.
Akram, if you can comment on the United States working with the Jordanian Air Force, dropping 38,000 ready-to-eat meals, largely on the beach in Gaza. If you can respond to, we just played clips of mass protest, that there was protest around the world, but one person in Washington, D.C. Commented on the fact that while the U.S. is dropping this food, they should stop providing Israel with the bombs they drop on Palestinians.
The clearer analysis of this situation when it comes to the cause and effect relationship between Israel and the misery that the Palestinians have been living, United States and the misery that Palestinians have been living. Three C-103 planes were dropping food on the Palestinians, while countless number of F-16s, F-15s, F-22s, and F-35s, also with the most advanced technology and with the ammunition that are provided by the United States to the Israel. So in one hand, they are providing people with food, and in the other hand, they are providing people with death, taking their lives. I think the United States should be reconsidering its position when it comes to providing Israel with killing ammunitions, and thinking that they are providing people in Gaza with around 35,000 or 36,000 meals that are ready to eat. The Palestinians might not be able to eat them. And some of the airdropped assistance that was dropped in Gaza went to the sea. And one of the people that I was talking to, he was joking and mocking the whole situation we are living in. He was saying the fish is very grateful for the American administration because they dropped the food that was sent to Gaza to the fish in the Gaza Sea. And I think a president that is dropping the aid for the Ukrainians while the Gaza is the target is in a way and needs to reconsider everything about that, and they need to make sure that they provide unhindered access through the recognized crossings of Gaza for the people who are displaced in the Gaza South and in the Gaza North. So it's somehow Palestinians find it ridiculous. Palestinians find it a way that needs to be reviewed and changed.
What word are you getting of ceasefire negotiations? And also, what is happening on the ground where you are in Rafah right now? Al Jazeera reporting at least 11 were killed, 50 wounded after an Israeli air attack on a tent housing displaced people next to an entrance to a hospital in Rafah City, not far from where you are standing.
Well, the negotiations are still underway. It looks like Israel has some demands to make. Some of them were not agreed upon in the past, but now they are coming up with them. Palestinians don't have high expectations when it comes to the negotiation. Palestinians are extremely busy now trying to survive because of the expansion of the ground operation in Khan Yunis area. They have already targeted, the Israeli occupation targeted Hamad city area and also the Al-Gharara area, which is an expansion of the ground operation that has been already starting in Khan Yunis for the last, have been already rolling in Khan Yunis for the last 3 months. The Israeli occupation forces targeted a tent by a hospital in the Rafah west area, and they also targeted a home. The number of people who are killed in Rafah for the last 24 hours is more than 50 people in different incidents taking place in different parts of Rafah. So the misery is continuous and the bombardment is continuous, and the number of Palestinians who are killed because of that and the number of people who are displaced because of that is increasing, I would say, by the second, not by the minute.
Finally, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, has the negotiating team boycotting the negotiations now in the ceasefire negotiations in Cairo because he says Hamas has refused as part of the deal to provide the list of living hostages. Your thoughts on this and where these negotiations stand?
As a matter of fact, that I've been following the news about this from the Israeli media sources and from the Palestinian media sources as well. That specific request was not made by the Israeli security forces or security agencies in the past. Now Netanyahu is inventing something new for the sake of just continuing the delay. It looks like this delay is taking place for some purely political reasons, where Netanyahu is interested in prolonging the war. They have disputes, they have issues. One of the top leaders is now in the USA. Netanyahu is busy calling the Blinken and calling other people, telling them that it is an unauthorized trip. It looks like there is something that is internally happening in the Israeli political arena that Netanyahu wants to stop and prevent from happening. And that's why everything that he wants to do eventually reflects on the Palestinians. Now more killing, more displacement, now refusing the request to provide some names, now asking to provide some names. So I think we will see a great deal of procrastination like the one that we have been seeing for the past few months. Netanyahu is interested in his personal safety when it comes to his political career, political life, and I think that's why even the security, Israeli security forces that are not being able to end this military confrontation with the Palestinian factions in Gaza are now trying to, through the political means, to come to a, would say, honorable end for this, but they are failing to do so.
You're talking about Benny Gantz being in Washington now to meet with today Kamala Harris, Tony Blinken she'll be meeting with, and other officials. I wanted to finally ask you about the issue of famine, about the number of children who are dying of hunger and dehydration, and how the Palestinians are dealing with this at this point.
Well, according to the statistics that were released by the Palestinian Minister of Health, around 1 million Palestinians have developed some diseases of any kind, be them some diseases that have to do with the digestive system, with the respiratory system, with the upper respiratory system, which is indicative of the quality of life, where quality of life has reached in Gaza. And what is the situation of the public health? When you don't have water desalination plants, when you destroy the water purification systems, when you destroy destroy the solar panels that are on top of the houses of the people, when you destroy the heavy vehicles that are used by the municipalities to remove the waste, when you are destroying everything that has to do with the life of the Palestinians, this result is normal and is projected, and it will continue to deteriorate. Now with the children, 18 children have died in northern Gaza. More children are dying in southern Gaza. People cannot get decent food for their children. When people are drinking the water is polluted and it causes them some serious public health issues. And now the children are the most vulnerable people within the community. We have 1 million child in Gaza. 1 million child that do not have appropriate shelter, do not have appropriate feeding systems, they don't appropriate water systems, and they end up consuming water that is polluted, food that is polluted. They end up exposed. The twin that were killed yesterday, they were just twins, they were children. They were killed with their father. So they were deprived from the right to live, and they are still deprived from the right to access decent water, shelter, and food supplies. So this is the situation in Gaza as it is. It is an ongoing suffering because of the fact that Israeli occupation denied them the right to be treated as humans. This is the whole issue.
Akram al-Safari, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Gaza-based journalist speaking to us today from Rafah. Please be safe. When we come back, thousands gathered Friday in Moscow for the funeral of opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who died in an Arctic prison last month. Stay with us. Igor Stravinsky's A Sermon, A Narrative, and A Prayer, performed by CBC Symphony Orchestra. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Russia, where thousands gathered Friday in Moscow for the funeral of the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, weeks after he died February 16th in an Arctic prison at the age of 47. The funeral was live-streamed on Navalny's YouTube channel. This is a mourner outside the funeral.
I came to remember a good man who was deprived of his life. His family was deprived of love, of everything. We had hopes for him. It's very unfortunate. We are always visiting Nemtsov, and now we have one more place to visit. God forbid more places like these occur. We are very worried.
Navalny's family held a funeral service at a Moscow church with his body displayed in an open casket. His mother and father were at the ceremony. Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, is outside of Russia and could not attend. Neither could his children. Navalnaya has accused Putin of murdering her husband and delaying the release of his body to cover it up. The family reportedly wanted to bury Navalny Thursday, the same day as Russian President Vladimir Putin's annual State of the Nation address. Several foreign diplomats attended the funeral, including the U.S., German, and French ambassadors to Russia. The Kremlin's warned against unauthorized gatherings, and the Russian rights group OVD Info reported, quote, at least 67 arrests in 16 towns Friday, including 6 arrests in Moscow. Overall, the organization reports about 400 people have been detained at memorials and rallies across Russia since Navalny's death. Earlier today in Geneva, the UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk addressed the situation in Russia while giving his global update to the UN Human Rights Council. He expressed concerns about the persecution of Navalny and others in the run-up to Russia's presidential elections that start March 15th.
In the Russian Federation, the authorities have further intensified their repression of dissenting voices prior to this month's presidential election. Several candidates have been prevented from running due to alleged administrative irregularities. The death in prison of opposition leader Alexei Navalny adds to my serious concerns about his persecution. Since the onset of Russia's war in Ukraine, thousands of politicians, journalists, human rights defenders, lawyers, and people who have simply spoken their minds on social media have faced administrative and criminal charges, and this trend appears to have worsened in recent months, with many cultural figures being targeted. Last month, a new bill passed into law that further punishes people convicted of distributing information deemed to be false about Russia's armed forces, as well as people who seek to implement decisions by international organizations that the Russian Federation does not take part in. I urge a swift and comprehensive review of all cases of deprivation of liberty that result from the exercise of fundamental freedoms, as well as an immediate end to the repression of independent voices and the legal professionals who represent them. The future of the country depends on an open space.
For more, we're joined in Berkeley, California by Ilya Budryatskis, a Russian historian and political theorist who was previously based in Moscow and recently joined the University of California, Berkeley as a visiting scholar. He's a member of the Russian anti-war Posle.media, a leftist online platform founded after the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine. He's the author of the award-winning book Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia. His new piece for Jacobin is titled Alexei Navalny Taught Russia's Opposition How to Mobilize. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ilya. Can you talk about what you understand took place on Friday and the lead up to the funeral itself, how if people felt threatened, and the message that you think this funeral was to the world?
So thank you so much. So the first thing to say that the Russian authorities did a lot to prevent this funeral to happen, because they hided the body. They tried to prevent any public funerals in Moscow. So all this story happened during the week. And finally, they decided that it will be easier to make this funeral happen in the very suburb of Moscow. So it's important to know that the suburb, it's a long way to come there from, let's say, the center of the city. And of course, it happened just a day after the address of Putin, which was his main pre-election address to the nation. So that's why the authorities were not interested to attract too much attention to the funeral. The fact that more than 20,000 people came to this funeral in the suburbs, in the situation of fear, in the situation where everyone of these people could be arrested, prosecuted, and so on. So it's really amazing, because it's the first time during this, let's say, 2 years after the start of the war, when we saw such a big opposition rally in the city, and in Russia in general.
Was the family able to get an independent autopsy? The Kremlin said that he died of natural causes. Navalny, of course, was 47 years old.
So first thing to say that Navalny was tortured in prison. So he spent more than 200 days in so-called prison cell. So it's a prison inside the prison with extremely hard conditions. And we still don't know for sure the reasons of his death, if it was the result of torture or it was the outcome of the poisoning. But for me, it's quite clear that anyway he was killed, because what we saw it was murder which happened consistently during his prison term.
You write in your Jacobin piece, and now after the murder of Navalny and faced with the rise of authoritarian forms of capitalism around the world, we must remember that without basic freedom of speech and assembly, the left and the oppressed have very little chance of winning anything. Do you hold out hope in Russia? I mean, you have Navalny's wife, Yulia, saying she's going to take on the mantle. What about forms of leadership within Russia that are dissenting, the other forms of opposition?
The success of Navalny as a leader that unified opposition, that was able to start mobilizations, mass mobilizations in Russia, it's all happened before the war. When he was poisoned in 2020, and after it, he understood that the only way to continue his activity as a public leader is to come back to the country. So for now, we have the situation in Russia, which is totally different with what was before the war. So for now, we live in the open, dictatorship, where any forms of public disobedience are forbidden. And of course, for Yulia Navalny, it will be very hard to present herself as the alternative leader being outside of the country. But on the other side, that's the only opportunity for the moment to speak publicly, to address Russian audience with open anti-war, anti-Putin slogans is to be in abroad. I think your position is very controversial in the sense, it's very challenging.
Finally, Ilya, your thoughts on this second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russian army sustained nearly 30,000 casualties in February alone, making it the bloodiest month for Russia since the war began. And you have the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, hinting at a potential focus on occupied Crimea this year. Put those together.
So for now, we have the situation where the Russian army is taking initiative. Because Russia definitely has much more arms, it has much more people to mobilize, to turn into soldiers, and the situation for Ukraine is not very promising for the moment. For Russia, the goals of this war is still very unclear, because if you follow Russian propaganda, if you follow statements of some people around Putin, you can see that they're openly talking about how to occupy Kyiv, how to occupy Odessa. Today, there was a lecture, public lecture of the former president Dmitry Medvedev, how to divide Ukraine into parts. So some part will go to Poland, another part will go to Romania, and the main part of Ukraine, together with Odessa and Kharkov, will go to Russia. So you see clearly that Russia is ready to continue this war. It was very clear from Putin's address a week ago. So I think that situation is very clear. If Ukraine will be not supported from the West. Russia will continue its offensive and realize its final goal, the elimination of Ukraine as a state.
Ilya Budryatskis, I want to thank you for being with us. Russian historian and political theorist, previously based in Moscow, has just joined University of California, Berkeley, as a visiting scholar. We'll link to your piece on Jacobin. Alexei Navalny taught Russia's opposition how to mobilize. When we come back, we go to Alabama to speak with a journalist and artist who had been undergoing IVF treatments and was preparing to transfer her frozen embryos when the Alabama State Supreme Court ruled frozen embryos should be considered children. She just met with Vice President Kamala Harris. Stay with us. South Got a Change by Adia Victoria. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Reproductive health and medical groups have asked the Alabama Supreme Court to revisit its recent ruling that frozen embryos should be considered children. The decision sent shockwaves through the world of reproductive medicine as legal experts and infertility specialists try to address the potential effects on access to IVF, that's in vitro fertilization, and other fertility treatments. The defendants in the lawsuits, the Center for Reproductive Medicine and the Mobile Infirmary, on Friday filed a petition, and the Medical Association of the State of Alabama and the Alabama Hospital Association filed a brief in support. Last week, Alabama's Republican-controlled State House and Senate passed legislation to enact civil and criminal protections for IVF providers. But the bills do not change the classification of embryos as children. Neither bill even mentions the word embryo. This came after a single Republican senator blocked quick passage Friday of a bill to create federal protections for in vitro fertilization. The measure was introduced by Democratic Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, who had both of her daughters using IVF. This is Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith of Mississippi who blocked the bill. But first, Senator Duckworth.
Women willing to go through expensive, painful medical treatments just for a chance to experience the smallest, most banal moments of parenthood. Just to have a newborn to swaddle, a baby whose diaper needs to be changed, a toddler who needs their shoes to be tied. And if you believe that they have the right to be called mom without also being called a criminal, then all you have to do to prove it is to let us pass this should be obvious legislation.
The court's holding in favor of the parents found that these frozen human embryos are children under Alabama law. It did not ban IVF, nor has any state banned IVF. The bill before us today is a vast overreach that is full of poison pills that go way too far, far beyond ensuring legal access to IVF.
The recent Alabama Supreme Court ruling stems from appeals cases brought by three couples whose frozen embryos at a reproductive clinic in Mobile, Alabama, were accidentally destroyed when a hospital patient dropped them on the floor. In a 7-2 decision, the Alabama Supreme Court ruled the couples can now sue the clinic for wrongful death. The decisions partly hinged on anti-abortion language added to the Alabama Constitution in 2018 that says the state recognizes the, quote, rights of the unborn child. Unquote. For more, we're joined in Birmingham, Alabama by Abby Crane, journalist and artist who'd been undergoing IVF treatments for nearly 2 years and was preparing to transfer her frozen embryos when the Alabama State Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos can be considered children. On Thursday, she traveled to the White House to meet with Vice President Kamala Harris for a private meeting. Abby Crane also reports on women and gender issues for the news outlet Reckon. We welcome you to Democracy Democracy Now!, Abby. Can you start off by responding to the Alabama Supreme Court ruling and then talk about how it's affected you personally?
Hi, thanks for having me. When it first came out, I was aware of the ruling and what they were trying to do. And then on Wednesday, this past Wednesday, I saw on actually social media on Instagram that my clinic was pausing in response. My first reaction was just sheer rage. I was extremely angry and honestly fell apart for a little bit.
How does it affect what you're going through? I mean, I think what's missing in a lot of the coverage is what people go through when you undergo IVF. The hopes and dreams you have, but also physically what this means.
Sure. So I've been undergoing IVF for the past 2 years, but I've been receiving infertility treatment for the last 5 years. So the ups and downs of, you know, injecting yourself with hormones, the ways it affects your mental health, the ways it affects your physical body, the pain of the procedures. You constantly have to be in this, you know, when you're in it, I say I compartmentalize the hope. When I'm in it, I try to be present and hopeful. But, you know, when I've taken a pause on the procedures, I have to just put it away in order to, you know, put one front of the other and do something else. But I am so fortunate. I'm thankful that I was not in the middle of a procedure or on medication currently, or had a egg retrieval scheduled. I can't imagine the folks that were actually in the middle of treatment. But because, you know, we were gearing up to schedule a implantation, the fact that these men down the street from me who serve on the Alabama Supreme Court have more say over when I choose to become a mother right now than me. And that's the reality of things is I don't care how quickly that they resolve this, that they put in their exception for IVF. The damage has already been done to folks who are in this, to me personally.
I really think
they kind of showed their cards.
Can you move your frozen embryos to another state?
I don't know that yet. Right now, all I've received from my clinic is just kind of the standard what they've been sending everybody, and I think what most people can access through press releases. Right now, I don't think there are places that will transport them from Alabama, just because I think the transportation companies are looking at things the same way the fertility clinics are, in which they could be liable for embryos that were damaged.
Can you talk about your meeting with Vice President Harris? What did you talk about? And what do you think of the fact that Congress is trying to protect IVF and that was blocked? Tammy Duckworth, the senator who had both her kids by IVF, and the Mississippi senator blocked it.
It's enraging. I found that out while, like, I think it was right after I had met with the vice president. But yeah, I got to have a one-on-one private meeting with her, talking to her about my experience, her talking about how important it is for folks like me to continue speaking on this and sharing our story and showing that the folks in power, they playing politics, it harms real life people and affects real, vulnerable, nuanced conversations between patients and doctors.
Abby, The Alabama Republican House Representative Terry Collins introduced an IVF protection bill into the Alabama State House. Now, you're supporting this legislation, but you're concerned about the record of the state rep, Collins, and other Alabama Republicans on reproductive rights.
Yeah, I believe I heard her on this program earlier. You know, she was, she did the 2019 Alabama bill that, or law that banned abortion should Roe v. Wade be overturned with no exceptions to rape and incest. And, you know, it got all into personhood. And I think the cognitive dissonance is enraging that, you know, I have interviewed this woman who has children, and to talk about her beliefs on reproductive health, and, you know, she is insistent that life begins at conception. And I don't understand how these folks are pushing to have their cake and eat it too, in saying that, you know, these embryos, which weren't even referenced in the bill, like you said, are humans, while any other reproductive health choice, including abortion and miscarriage, could be affected by Alabama's current laws on abortion.
Finally, Abby, you wrote in Glamour, "I want people reading this who don't live in Alabama to know that you're not special and you are not safe." We're going to begin part two of our conversation and put it online with that point.